resistance. Africa Now is next. To show Muizo Muntali. The music in the background is African People by Christine Kamau. Today, Africa Now goes into its archives to commemorate the birthday on January 5th of Dr. Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who joined the ancestors 7 months ago on May 28, 2025. The show features a conversation with Dr. Ngugi wa Thiong'o and Dr. Meseri Githai Mugu. We recorded at the annual meeting of the African Studies Association in Washington, D.C. in December 2016. The discussion was commemorating the 40th anniversary of the play The Trial of Dedan Kimathi by Dr. Ngugi wa Thiong'o and Dr. Meseri Githai Mugu, released in 1976 when both professors were at the University of Nairobi. The Trial of Dedan Kimathi is the response to colonialist writings about the freedom movement in Kenya and its leader Dedan Kimathi. In their discussion, the noted ancestor professors focus on the act of naming and self-naming. Dr. Ngugi wa Thiong'o concentrates on the politics of memory and the effects of name and position on the psyche of colonized people. Dr. Meseri Githai Mugu looks at the politics of renaming and self-naming as continued forms of resistance to colonial imposition. The late Dr. Meseri Githai Mugu was Emeritus Meredith Professor for Teaching Excellence at Syracuse University, and she was past chair of the Department of African American Studies at Syracuse University. Dr. Mugu was a poet, playwright, and literary critic who published 6 books, 8 co-edited supplementary school readers, 3 monographs, and edited the journal Third World in Perspectives. Professor Mugu was also recipient of numerous honors. The late Dr. Ngugi wa Thiong'o was a renowned novelist, essayist, playwright, journalist, editor, academic, and social activist, and was a distinguished professor of English and comparative literature at the University of California in Irvine. Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o was author of numerous publications since the 1960s. We begin with Dr. Ngugi wa Thiong'o concentrating on the politics of memory and the effects of name imposition on the psyche of a colonized people.
Naming and the politics of memory. Kimathi and Kenya, Land and Freedom Army. I have always been fascinated by the encounter between the shipwrecked Crusoe and the native he purportedly rescues from cannibalistic neighbors in Daniel Defoe's novel Robinson Crusoe. Presumably, this native is also a cannibal, but at no point in the narrative does he make any attempt to consume his rescuer. But it is Crusoe's education program that I find most striking. First, he assumes that the native does not know anything about anything, including their own body. So, unlike Shakespeare's Prospero, the earlier shipwrecked, who takes it that Caliban knows the geography of the island, its fresh springs, its natural endowments, and therefore first seeks that knowledge before turning Caliban into a slave, Crusoe seeks no such things from the native. Instead, he sets out to teach the native. The order of knowledge is most telling. He starts with names. Your name is Friday, because I discovered you on a Friday. And mine is Master. Note he doesn't say Crusoe. Yours is Friday and mine is Master. We're to assume that pre-Crusoe Friday had a name by which he identified himself and was identified by his relatives and neighbors. He also had a name by which he identified the things around him, plants, animal, places. Otherwise, communication between him, his relatives, and neighbors would have consisted of a gesture, a la the dwellers of Swift's laughter, who, dispensing the words, carry objects to point at instead of signifying them with sounds. You dispense with language, you just point. We can also assume that names as words which the native had used before their fatal encounter must also have acquired a history, a memory around them. And this is what Crusoe erases with his renaming system. Names define relationships to self, other selves, and the environment. So renaming Friday is a barrier of previous identity and histories, and a new identities and histories. The new names will forever define the terms of relationship between Crusoe and Friday. That is the discoverer and the discovered, the foreign expert and the native recipient, the knowing expert and the native ignomaras, the naming master and the named native. Naming becomes the right of conquest, and names the mark of conquest. In my book, Something Torn and New, I have talked a great deal about the politics of memory and the centrality of naming, renaming, misnaming in the power struggle between the subjugating and the subjugated, in our case, the colonizer and colonized. Explorations, preludes to actual colonization of new territories and peoples, went hand in hand with renaming. America had a name or names before Columbus and Amerigo. Canada too, New Zealand, Australia as well. So central was the naming to the colonial process that when one power replaced another, they often re-renamed the same place. That's for a quick example. That's for reason New York had named which the pre-colonized natives called it. The Dutch colonial occupant called it New Amsterdam. The English conquerors of the Dutch renamed it New York. Not surprisingly, naming has always been a linguistic arm of war, conquest, and subjugations. One obvious way has been the use of terms that dehumanize the opponents. On a small scale, we saw it in full display during the recent American elections. Trump, early on, discovered the power of projection of his own negative qualities onto the other. And that's when Jeb Bush became Low Energy Bush, Ted Cruz became Lying Ted, and Hillary Clinton, Crooked Hillary. Some of these carried conviction and consistency because indeed they were projections of his own traits onto others. His followers and even the media came to repeat the terms over and over again. Whatever the repetition of the same, even where the press attributed them to the source, can shape and need shape people's perceptions of the named. The same dehumanization of the other through names happens in all wars on all sides. But in a situation where two sides are matched in power, where indeed they have equally matched machinery of propaganda, the renamings may neutralize each other. Not obviously the case in colonial and anti-colonial wars, in their access to means of propaganda. One side, the colonial state machinery, outmatches the anti-colonial side altogether. Nearly all the armed resistance in Africa, Kenya, Algeria, Guinea-Bissau, Zimbabwe, South Africa, were described as terrorist organizations, and their leaders, or even supposed leaders, from Jomo Kenyatta to Nelson Mandela, described as taking the population back to darkness and death. In the case of Mandela, it was not until 2008 that Mandela was finally removed from the terrorist list in the USA. Language itself is a vast naming system. And so when one language overpowers another, it acquires, because the language of power, it acquires a monopoly of naming the world, including terms for education and knowledge. In the case of Africa, concepts to fit into the idea of the primitive other become normalized as the basis of new histories and philosophies, and which then come to define reality, even in scholarship, politics, and in national and international relations among groups and processes. Among the most devastating in both politics and scholarship is the word tribe, for instance. I'm just taking one word, tribe, which is inherited from colonial anthropology. I have talked about the distorting effects of the term in my book, Secure the Base, Making Africa Visible in the Globe. So I'll not dwell too much on it here, except to voice my constant dismay when I hear the term used. I have used the term myself in the past, so I cannot be too holier than thou. But today, it makes me feel, literally, like throwing up when it's being used by anybody. So when I used to refer to African peoples or any peoples anywhere elsewhere, I ask myself this question: why are 300,000 Icelanders a nation and over 10 million Zulus a tribe? The Danes are 4 million. Norwegians about 6 million. Swedes about 8 million. I've never heard any of these peoples referred to as tribes. But 40 million Yorubas, or even 60 million Hausas, are tribes. Or, equally insulting, ethnic groups. 40 million people become an ethnic group. When the word is used in combination with the other, say tribal wars, then I'm telling you, then all thinking and common sense stops. For instance, if there are disagreements, even fatal ones, between two leaders in Africa, one has only to look at the communities they come from and quickly conclude that their disagreements are essentially tribal. One looks at leaders in Africa, and all that one needs to know about their politics is to know the communities they come from. Then it all has to do with tribe A and tribe B. Even dictatorships are looked at from the standpoint of the communities they come from. There are many other terms equally reprehensible. European colonial fighters are soldiers. African fighters are warriors. Unless, of course, they have been co-opted into the colonial armies, suddenly the former warrior becomes a soldier. As far as I know, there are no communities that I know of where all their members live to fight. In a true sense, the only warriors, those that live to fight, were the standing armies of the colonial state, because they were there to fight. They were warriors. Projection the other. But the notion of the irrational has deep roots in terms like tribes, tribal wars, and tribal mentality, ultimately to the notion that colonialism was driven by the ideals of enlightenment, in another word, the continent. Hegel's view of Africa and African people as enveloped in the dark mantle of the night. A scholarship that inherits a vocabulary forged in explorer narratives can actually obscure reality of social inequalities, economic disparities, misrule, the continued consumption of 90% of the resources of the continent by Western corporations. The terms absolve some scholars from thinking altogether, or absolve them from digging up facts and rigorous analysis altogether. Even studies in corruption become studies in the tribal affiliation of the actors. It's as if the corrupt elite, even where they are emissaries of corrupt corporations, suddenly become representatives of the community they come from. For some scholars, this framing of African societies in stereotypes ensures that all social divisions in an African society go by the window, simply because they all fit into the prefixed ethnic boxes. And here's the problem. Every African citizen of any nation in Africa comes from a given community. A scholar, any scholar of the continent, African or non-African, is doing a lot of harm tribalizing the analysis of a continent that over the last hundreds of years has undergone the trauma of slave trade, colonial plantations, and today, debt slavery. From 17th century to the present, Europe and the West generally has looted 90% of the African resources to develop Europe and the West. So the real story of Africa is how it has survived the loot, the terror, and the trauma of those disasters. But for Hegel's intellectual descendants, even Africans, because there are some descendants of Hegel, tribe trumps all such contradictions. So here, let me digress a little and offer my simple solution for those that really desire to free themselves from the prison house of the tribe. Please call people by the name they call themselves. We talk of the English or English people, the French or the French people, the Germans or the German people, the Chinese or the Chinese people, the Japanese or the Japanese people, do the same for Africa and all other peoples, whatever the size of the population. There's of course also the perfectly good word, nationality, for the distinct communities and people that nevertheless constitute the nation or the multinational state. But still, the clearest thing, you don't have any ambiguities. If I'm Yoruba, I'm Yoruba, and I come from Yoruba people, okay? Nothing illustrates better the politics of naming than the case of Kenya's Land and Freedom Army, led by Daniel Kimathi. Their motto was summed up by their popular words of greetings. And I used to hear this, Maudu no mere, idaka na weyavi. When they met, only two things only, land and freedom. You see, if the British called them by the name they called themselves, then they would have been articulating those fundamental goals of the Liberation Army. By the time Mau Mau obscured the goals, it sounded like some mystical mumbo jumbo conjuring irrationality. The mumbo jumbism, seen as some kind of retreat from civilization, was at the heart of theories of the colonial, like Carothers, Henderson, and Caulfield. In my recent memoir, Battle of Dreamweaver, I've shown how the three actually drew from each other, like one lie cited to reinforce another. And in the case of Carothers, I've traced his theories all the way back to those of the Cartwright in the American slave plantations, who theorized that the desire of a slave to run, of the enslaved to run away, was a mental disease called dreptomania. But the accounts of activities and character of the Kenya Land and Freedom Army are real extensions, with footnotes at all, of the vocabulary of the Enlightenment scholarship, desirous of obscuring the reality of slave trade, slavery, and the barbarism inherent in those practices. A bizarre outcome of this have been scholarly attempts to portray Kenya Land and Freedom Army as a civil war amongst the Agikoyo. Civil war, the term, is driven by this imperative behind tribe and tribal wars. The Home Guards is actually set up by General Hind in 1954. Literally set up by the colonial state, were an auxiliary arm of the British forces. They were part of the British Army, as were all the African members of the Kenya African Rifles. Even some otherwise first-rate scholars of the period have fallen victims of this view. And there are some good, very good scholars, but their scholars become obscured by this notion of the civil war, right? I have not kept up with the scholarship on this period of Kenyan history, and I may have missed it. But I would like to see a comparative study of the Nazi concentration camps and those of the British and those the British colonial state called detention camps in Kenya. Because the British had just engaged with Hitler. It would compare the two. I recently met a Kenyan scholar in Germany who is looking at the German Herero massacres as the precursor of Hitlerism and the mass murders in Europe. Either way, it all comes back to colonialism. There are many scholars, both African and those from outside Africa, who have done and continue to do excellent work and have produced first scholarship on the continent. Let us therefore all become scholars of Africa and not experts who work in categories inherited from colonial anthropology and colonial mindset. This may have to start by jettisoning vocabulary of stereotyping and call Mau Mau by its correct designation as Kenya Land and Freedom Army, or simply LFA, and then Kimathi as the first of the many liberation armies that finally broke the back of imperialism in its colonial form. Thank you.
And that was Dr. Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who was concentrating on the politics of memory and the effects of name and position on the psyche of colonized people. Next, you'll hear Dr. Mercy Githai Mugu, who's looking at the politics of renaming and self-naming as continued forms of resistance to colonial deposition. We're going in our archives to play the discussion of the noted ancestor professors focusing on the act of naming and self-naming to commemorate the birthday on January 5th of Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who joined the ancestors 7 months ago on May 28, 2025. Now you're going to hear Dr. Mercy Githai Mugu looking at the politics of naming and self-naming as continued forms of resistance to colonial imposition. The music in the background is African Mister by Kasiva Mutua. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
Kimathi Mau Mau and the politics of naming is our broad subject, and my side presentation is the politics of renaming and self-naming. So my colleague, comrade and co-author Ngugi wa Thiong'o has just eloquently and compellingly spoken on the politics of naming and their impact on the psyche of the colonized, giving illustrations from the histories of colonialism and imperialism. The tragedy is actually that the misnaming, as he has argued, does stick and did stick under colonialism. In fact, this explains why among some colonized people, we find African translating their African names so that they have equivalents of the English equivalents of them. For instance, a beautiful name among the Shona people like Chipo, which means gift. Then you meet somebody and you are introduced to a lady called Gift, and it doesn't quite register as Chipo, but that's Gift. But there have been even more hilarious examples that my daughters and I encountered when we lived in Zimbabwe and became Zimbabwean citizens. There was a young boy at a market that we used to go and get vegetables from, called Mbare Market, whose name was Anyway. And another one of his friends who was called Nevermind, and I'm not joking. And then, in fact, there was a third one that we met much later on called Why Not. And I'm not making this up, it's a fact. Colonial forms of imposed naming and self-naming were not just ridiculous, but mischievously cruel, to say the very least. They made a joke of colonized people, robbing them of their true identity and dignity, and in fact, cutting them off from the familiar and affirming cultural sites of their upbringing and self-naming. But fortunately, as we all know, history and life are dialectical processes. And so, even as the colonials were busy attempting to erase the identity of their subjects by imposing colonial and foreign namings upon them, many of those targeted were always, always, all the time, busy resisting and defiantly engaging in the process of renaming and self-naming, refusing to be the Fridays of Robinson Crusoe's imperialist design, let alone his possible Saturdays and Sundays. More importantly, they recognize the importance of renaming and self-naming themselves, for naming and self-naming are critical milestones along the journey of life in most African cultures. And in fact, their significance is ingrained in people from birth. In fact, a lot of the cultures of Africa hold a very special actual naming ceremony that is witnessed by the community, because this self-identity is so important and it's also linked to the group. Others even have what is called second birth, which is a ceremony at which an individual's arrival or birth is affirmed, confirmed through another name being given to them or reconfirmation of the original one. To emphasize the significance of naming in African cultures, allow me to illustrate from a personal example. I am one of those lucky formerly colonized people who are fortunate enough to grow up soaking knowledge from and feeding off the world of Oricha in the late 1940s and 50s. I still recall with a lot of nostalgia those evenings, usually around the hearth, but also in the sitting room following dinner, when my mother or grandmother or aunt would convert the spaces into classrooms, which I shared with my siblings, cousins, and other young neighbors listening to stories. My maternal grandmother in particular was an amazing, amazing storyteller. But before treating us to a storytelling session, she would always begin with the family tree, which in a lot of African cultures was a very important site and place and space for naming, self-naming, and collective naming. It went something like this. For instance, if she pointed at me, she would ask, "What is your name?" And I would say, "My name is Mishere." "Mishere wow, Mishere daughter of who?" "Mishere wa Karuga." "Karuga wow, Karuga son of who?" "Karuga wa Githae." "Githae wow, Githae wa Githi." "Githi wow." And it would go on like that until you went generations back. And I remember there was a time that I could recite my ancestors and sites of namings and belonging 20 generations from, you know, when we were young. Sometimes my grandmother would pause and ask the respondent to name a historical milestone associated with the life of one of the members of the family tree that had been evoked. So names, as I say, were linked to family, major life events, and very importantly, to history. Consequently, this ritual at the beginning of each storytelling session by my grandmother took the audience on a journey back, Sankofa-like, in history, making linkages, connections, jogging memories to rememory, urging us never to forget. This is the historical connection that Haile Gerima revamps in his film Sankofa, symbolized by the image of the Sankofa bird flying forward with its head turned backwards while carrying an egg in its beak. Powerful, powerful symbolic image. To wit, this is the significance of the unborn child in Julie Dash's film Daughters of the Dust, where the unborn simultaneously connects the present to the past and to the future, where, paradoxically, the unborn has the spirit and seasoned wisdom of Nana Peasant, the elder matriarch in that film. And beyond Nana, she also has connection to the ancestral world. So Nana, the ancestral spirit, and the unborn child merge their voices and urge the Peasant family, as members are moving from the island to the main island, never to forget their names, to carry their names, to carry their identities with them, to carry their history as they migrate and move to another place. They had to make history move with them. They had, as it were, to intervene within those critical moments in order to make sure that the thread had not been broken. So yes, naming is a serious, serious event and process in most African cultures. As indicated, one's name is linked to the family, extended family, the community, and to the ancestral world. At other times, as I have said, naming is associated with life events and phenomena that influence collective social being and individual being. Now, this knowledge the colonizers had through the anthropologists or missionaries and so on, or collaborators, they knew very well. And hence the reason why, under Christian and colonial education, the learners had to be renamed. I remember, for instance, when I went to register for school, they insisted on my producing another name other than Michere. And so, luckily, I had one, Madeleine. I have no idea what my parents were naming me after or what the name means, but I'm called Madeleine. And you know, I'm ashamed to say it has hung around in my signature. I've got to find ways of getting rid of it. But Madeleine, I became, and there was this very schizophrenic relationship with yourself when you were in school, you were one person, one name, and when you were home, you were another person, and so on. Just ridiculous, really. So then this renaming that Ngugi was talking about. Now, a vivid and scary example of this is in the documentary In the White Man's Image. The documentary tells the story of an experiment conceived in St. Augustine, Florida in 1875, through which Native American children were to be converted into imitation whites. The U.S. Congress actually backed this plan and commissioned the founding of a school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, run by a colonial educator by the name of Richard Henry Pratt, to accomplish this civilizing mission. Young Native American children were forcefully torn from their parents, families, and homes and taken to Carlisle, where they were put in military-like uniform and barracks, had their hair cut white fashion, and were given white names. In fact, they were not given. They would go and pick one from the hat. And whatever you picked from the hat, whether John or Charles or whatever became your name. That is, in fact, how coincidental it was. And when you compare this with the seriousness of cultures that really have a place for names and naming, this was a serious crime on the psyche. So then, in this civilizing mission, the native children were torn from their families and homes and familiar places. And then they were taught English and forbidden to speak their own mother tongue. They were also forbidden to visit their homes for 5 years. During those 5 years of cloning, deracination, and isolation from their homes, communities, and culture, these learners were literally drilled into eliminating the Indian in them. The language used to describe this process is really, really chilling. Repeatedly we hear, the only good Indian is a dead one. And another phrase, kill the Indian and save the man. And this was the process, to virtually kill the Indian in order to save the man. Man in Western civilization sense. The experiment, of course, resulted in suicides, genocide, and permanent psychological scars among First Nations people. Now, versions of this experiment are to be found throughout the history of colonialism. Frantz Fanon was right, therefore, in arguing that liberating physical space, land, for instance, was a much easier task than liberating an invaded mind. Now, writers, artists, educators, and journalists and all kinds of people have a central part to play in the liberation of the mind. Indeed, in Return to My Native Land, upon returning to Martinique from Europe, the first task that Aimée Césaire, the poet, engages in is the renaming of his homeland following years of colonial uprootment and ravaging. He insists on finding his voice and the language to rename his surroundings, the land, the terrain, the flora and fauna, the rivers, the seasons, and so on, using his own language on his own terms. He also learns to tune his ears to the conversations and rhythms, to the conversations and rhythms of speech of ordinary Martinican people, survivors of colonial onslaught, in order to tell their story with them. Now, in composing The Trial of Dedan Kimathi, Ngugi and I were not only highly aware of all the dialectics and sites of contestation that I have outlined above, but also deeply conscious of our role as artists in the challenging task of denouncing colonial and imperialist misnaming and misrepresentation of the history of the Kenya Land and Freedom Army, or so-called Mau Mau, and its leader, Field Marshal Dedan Kimathi. And Ngugi and I just went off with our imagination to reimagine and rename these sites that had been maligned under colonialism. So then, while feeling the urgency to embark on the work of renaming and self-naming, we were also keenly aware of the fact that we could not do this authentically without revisiting indigenous sites of knowledge, such as living witnesses and orature, including oral historical narratives, myths, legends, stories, songs, and so forth. We needed these counter-narratives to debate with accounts like Elspeth Huxley's A Thing to Love, or Ian Henderson's The Hunt for Kimathi, Robert Ruark's Uhuru and Something of Value, LSB Leakey's Mau Mau and the Kikuyu, Defeating Mau Mau, and others. Indeed, in the year 1974, 2 years before the publication of The Trial of Dedan Kimathi, we came across another version that seemed to us very close to these colonial sources. It was a play by Kenyan playwright Kenneth Watene that was performed at the Kenya National Theatre, which at the time was a site where Africans were not welcome. It was a place that was reserved for whites only, even though we were 10 years into independence. So we saw this play, and the play seemed to us to be the latest narrative at the time, confirming most of the false namings and stereotypes that were unleashed upon Kimathi and the KLFA by colonial sources and their agents. In many of these colonial accounts, anyway, false naming is methodical and it's deliberate. Ngugi has spoken to the meaninglessness of the term Mau Mau, but besides this outrage, all manner of other vicious terms were used by the colonials to malign the fighters, such as terrorists, or in the Gikuyu language, itoi. Actually, in the Gikuyu language, it's a very ugly word, itoi, which can also translate into heartless criminals or evildoers. Or imaramari, even worse, you can hear even the onomatopoeic sounding imaramari, was another term that would mean something like roaming, wild, lawless vagabonds. Some even called the fighters oragani, killers, and one could go on. I remember that there were stories and myths we were told as children that they used to drink people's blood, and this made us fear these cannibals that were out there in the forest. But in any case, this false naming criminalized the freedom fighters, depicting them as inhumane beasts whose single mission was to engage in senseless bloodshed. These patriots were painted as purposeless destroyers and enemies of the people. Kimathi was vilified as a cruel dictator who ruled through fear and terror. Some accounts even depicted him as an egomaniac and psychopath who had no heart. Conversely, the masses and supporters of the KLFA had alternative namings for these very same fighters, referring to them in endearing language, such as Itungati a term that loosely translates into those who serve, the servants of the people. They also endearingly referred to them as Anake or Iheshia Mutito, boys of the forest, or as Njambashia Bururi, heroes of the land. They loved and revered Field Marshal Dedan Kimathi. Now, thus reading counter-narratives such as Karari Njama's Mau Mau from within, J.M. Kariuki's Mau Mau Detainee, and other autobiographical accounts by former freedom fighters, and even more importantly, as I have said, discovering or richer sources and narratives that told completely different stories of Kimathi and the KLFA, then listening to some living witnesses who knew Kimathi, Ngugi and I came up with alternative forms of naming. In the preface to our play, The Trial of Dedan Kimathi, we share our experiences from a research trip that took us to Karunaini, Kimathi's place of birth. The oral narratives the people we met shared spoke of a Kimathi that was completely antithetical to the one of colonial naming. A lengthy quotation from the preface summarizing these witnesses' memories of Kimathi will help clinch the point that I'm trying to make here. I quote, Ngugi and I say, the writing of The Trial of Dedan Kimathi has been both challenging and exciting. It has put us through a lot of education in connection with the continuing struggle against economic and other forms of oppression. We also discovered that Kimathi was still a hero of the Kenyan masses. One day, for instance, we visited Kimathi's birthplace with the aim of eliciting a first-hand assessment of Kimathi from the people who had known him as a child, a villager, and guerrilla hero. Karunaini people were very proud of their son. They talked of him as a dedicated teacher, committed organizer of a theater group that he had named in the village Gichamu, as a man with a tremendous sense of humor who could keep a house roaring with laughter. They talked of his warm personality and his love of people. He was clearly their beloved son, their respected leader, and they talked of him as still being alive. Kimathi will never die, the woman among that crowd told us. Then she continued and said, but if you people have killed him, go, show us his grave. She said this in a strange tone and voice between defiance and bitterness. And for a minute, we all kept quiet. Now, you may argue that this is a romanticization of the hero, and that's okay, as Paulo Freire tells us, especially among colonized people, to have positive myths about yourselves is very, very healthy, because that way you are cleaning out the false myths that you have been fed with. The only thing is to learn to recognize between facts and imagination, and also to understand the difference between reality and the creations of our imagination, which are very, very healthy. So then, in The Trial of Dedan Kimathi, we have tried to honor and preserve these counter-narratives, using them to remap and rename the shaky ground upon which the false myths of colonial and imperialist history leave Kimathi standing. We have tried to show that the Kenya liberation struggle was not a civil war as such, but a war about occupation ignited by the oppressive conditions imposed upon the masses of Kenya by empire builders with white colonial settlers as occupiers. We have contested the notion that the struggle was a Kikuyu affair by evoking the presence of forest fighters from communities such as the Maasai, Nandi, Kipsigis, Samburu, Kisii, Akamba. And indeed, they were not in plenty. There were a few of them, but symbolically, this was very, very important. And this is not to deny the fact that the majority of fighters were from central Kenya, because after all, this is where the lands had been seized and renamed White Highland. Rather, it's an attempt to demonstrate that this was a Kenyan people's national struggle. And beyond this, as we heard from the panel this morning, the land, Kenya Land Freedom Army, and Kimathi in particular, were terribly conscious of other struggles going on around the continent, around the world, internationally and globally, and kept referring to them and comparing the experiences of oppressed Kenyan masses with what was happening in those other situations of war.
That was a portion of a discussion by Dr. Misiri Githai Mugu, looking at the politics of naming and self-naming as continued forms of resistance to colonial imposition. The late Dr. Misiri Githai Mugu was Emeritus Meredith Professor of Teaching Excellence at Syracuse University and past chair of the Department of African American Studies at Syracuse University. She was a playwright and literary critic who published 6 books and 8 co-edited supplementary school readers and 3 monographs and edited the journal Third World in Perspectives. Her full discussion will be on African Now's SoundCloud page. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. And earlier on, you heard Dr. Nguyu Athiong'o concentrating on the politics of memory and the effects of name imposition on the psyche of colonized people. We played this discussion from our archives of the noted ancestor professors on the act of naming and self-naming to commemorate the birthday on January 5th of Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who joined the ancestors, as you know, 7 months ago on May 28, 2025. We recorded the conversation of Dr. Ngugi wa Thiong'o and Dr. Misiri Githai Mugu at the annual meeting of the African Studies Association in Washington, D.C. in December 2016. The discussion was commemorating the 40th anniversary of the play The Trial of Dedan Kimathi by Ngugi wa Thiong'o and Misiri Githai Mugu. And you can revisit the full conversation on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Rejuvenation by Lonnie Liston Smith, commemorating his birthday, which was on December 28th. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Mutali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shahanana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East. And that's followed by Sophie's Parlor, the Women's Collective, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Sojourner Truth with Nana Jainfi, which is followed by Kwambeet Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nicella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Josh Myers, Kurt Odison, Chanda Kozer, and Fonan Gonda. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for your continued support of Africa Now and all the great programs on WPFW this year, and particularly during our recent end-of-year pledge drive. We're going to leave with a closing song entitled Kenya Land and Freedom Army by MC Tapari. Thank you, have a great day, have a great week, and stay safe, and Happy New Year. King radical, radical thing. King radical, radical thing. I want to tell them now. I go on music. Tell them. K-L-F-A. Madam! We don't tell them. K-L-F-A. Is that the microphone? Templar, tell them. Kenya Land and Freedom Army. Tell you about the Kenya Land and Freedom Army. Kenya Land and Freedom Army. Tell you about the Kenya Land and Freedom Army. Land General, Dedan Kimathi, Field Marshal, Musa Mwariama, Field Marshal, Mutoni Wakerema.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, December 31st. Here are some headlines. Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani will be sworn into office tomorrow in two separate ceremonies, formally beginning his term as New York City's mayor. WPFW's Noah Portner has this report.
Mayor-elect Mamdani will first be sworn in by a private midnight oath ceremony at the long-closed Old City Hall subway station, then a public ceremony on the steps of City Hall. The midnight swearing-in will be administered by New York Attorney General Letitia James, a prominent ally and major Trump opponent who has publicly praised Mamdani's rise. The second public ceremony is expected to draw large crowds, as well as Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. These two are the major voices of democratic socialism in the national arena. In the days leading up to the inauguration, Mamdani has rolled out early appointments, blending progressive figures with experienced city officials, many from previous mayoral administrations. Mamdani's swearing in marks a historic moment, as he becomes the first Muslim mayor and one of the city's youngest. He is, in fact, the first to be sworn in on the Quran. Mamdani will enter office backed by a coalition closely aligned with Attorney General James and New York's left-leaning political leadership. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
In more news, newly unsealed emails released yesterday in the criminal case against Kilmar Abrego Garcia provides evidence supporting the allegation that top officials in the Department of Justice played a greater role in bringing the charges of alleged human trafficking against Abrego Garcia than prosecutors have acknowledged so far. One of the emails released yesterday was sent by the U.S. Associate Attorney General and identifies the prosecution as a, quote, top priority, close quote. After it was found that Abrego Garcia was wrongfully deported to El Salvador's notorious Cicot prison in March, the Trump administration was ordered by the Supreme Court to bring him back to the United States to face indictment. Abrego Garcia is asking the charges against him to be thrown out on grounds of, quote, vindictive and selective prosecution, close quote. He argues that the administration unlawfully punished him as part of an apparent smear campaign for, quote, having the audacity to fight back, close quote. And Israel said yesterday that it will suspend more than two dozen humanitarian organizations, including Doctors Without Borders and CARE, for failing to comply with new vetting rules for international groups operating in Gaza. Israeli authorities say the organizations did not meet new registration requirements that include sharing detailed information about staff, funding, and operations. Israel continues to claim without evidence that Hamas is infiltrating the distribution of aid, a charge the aid groups have repeatedly denied. The health sector in Gaza has been largely destroyed, and Doctors Without Borders says that Israel's decision yesterday will have a devastating effect on its work in the enclave, where it supports about 20% of hospital beds and one-third of births. The organization also denied Israel's accusations about its staff. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
I don't know how much more a body can hold before it forgets it was meant for living, and I think of that when someone says hope is naive, and I have questions.